Welcome to the Abbott & Abbott podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. Chris Abbott, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
I am not Andy.
And I'm not Jerry.
Regular listeners to the podcast might recognise me. My name's John the Nice Guy. And as I said, I'm standing in for Andy this week. So Andy always does his wonderful piece about what this episode is. So this is episode 57. Everyone knows the 57 is the dialing code for Columbia. It's the advertising slogan for the Heinz variety and also the bingo call. It is, of course, as everyone knows, the atomic number of lithium. And I think Al's got something to confess. Yeah. It's his favourite class of diesel train.
It is, indeed.
Awesome. What can I say to that? I'm John the Nice Guy, but sitting next to me is a rather more famous man than I.
Famous. My name's Martin Wimpress. I work for Canonical on the Ubuntu and Snapcraft teams.
Cool. Yep, so we're at Org Camp this weekend, and I had a question. Well, it was something was asked me, my manager asked me actually. And, I wanted to come on, see what opinions people had. If I explain what I do, if you don't know, I work in a corporate environment, doing, HPE servers, but for using normally Windows and VMware. And we provide the whole solution, including help desk support and all the things that come along it. So, if you've got Microsoft Windows or the HP servers, we back-end support contracts with the companies who provide it, so with Microsoft or with HPE. So if we get any problems, we do the first line support for our customers, and then if we get any more problems, we can then go back to them with the logs or whatever to them help us solve it. So we have SLAs with those customers to fix those issues. Before we take on a support contract, someone has to go out and look at what their existing hardware and software and infrastructure is. And I got asked to do this piece of work so that I can hand it over to the support desk to do. And they were all running, it was a Visual Basic ASP.NET web server and what they provide on the VMware platform. But their load balancers were Linux. It was HA proxy running on Ubuntu. And obviously, they wanted us to manage the whole system so that if something went down, all they wanted to worry about is their code. They weren't worried about the underlying operating system. And my boss goes to me, well, we're not going to support that because who's going to fix if the software load balancer goes wrong at 4 o'clock in the morning? Who's going to fix that? Because that's open source. No one supports that. So I wanted to know, asking people who work in open source, how I can go back to my boss.
So it's a little bit awkward because I actually work for one of the rival firms to the firm that Al works for. And we also are in the same position where we have support contracts with various companies. But we've got support agreements with open source companies, and we have partner arrangements with those companies as well. So it, for me, from a high level overview perspective, it was a dead simple question to me, this. And I know where you're coming from with the question, because I've had similar conversations with my manager. But yeah, for me, my response has always been, it's a no-brainer, because you've got a support contract with a Red Hat or an Ubuntu, Canonical or SUSE or whoever else it is. But I've never worked in the sort of role where I would be making those escalations. So whilst I've always said to my management, well, surely it's just a matter of, handing it off to the vendor, I've never actually been involved in the conversation where you hand it off to a vendor.
Okay. So, although I work for Canonical, I'm not involved in the server or cloud teams at Canonical, I've been there for less than a year. But my history was doing a massive data center and compute clusters and stuff like that, all running on Linux, mostly Debian and Ubuntu. So I've been through this process, and I can tell you how I used to do it and how I would do it now if I was in this position today. So how I used to do it was I basically became a black belt Linux admin, and the buck stopped with me, and I was the poor so-and-so that would get out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning and go and fix these problems because I built the system, I designed the system, and I understood how it worked.
And now, you sang the theme tune?
Always. Your position is slightly different in that you've inherited a bit of technology that you didn't create.
Yes.
Now, as John says, a lot of these open source projects do have enterprise support models because although the open source software is free, it's not free to make it. You know, there's a lot of time and effort that goes into building these solutions. So you'll often find the high profile projects have enterprise support contracts that you can go to HAProxy and get a proper support contract that isn't, I might reply to your email if you email me and I'll get back to you in 4 days time. They're proper SLAs. So you can do that on a one-to-one basis. But what's very popular now, and I'll talk specifically about Ubuntu, but I'm sure OpenSUSE and Red Hat have similar services. In Ubuntu, there's a support umbrella called Bootstack. And it's the fastest growing area of the Ubuntu family of products and services. And people at Ubuntu engineers, will manage these specific devices that are running Ubuntu and an associated mix of technology. So things like HAProxy and Apache and MySQL and Postgres, you know, a whole raft of stuff. And they will look after it for you. So you can actually choose to just outsource that whole process to another organization. And they are an extension of your team of sysadmins who will just simply look after that stuff on your behalf.
I think that's you and me out of a job then.
Yep, sounds like it.
Thanks, Martin.
You're welcome.
Okay then, but no. So that's really interesting. So if I was looking to pick that sort of service up, would that engagement process go along the same sort of lines as a traditional outsourcing engagement? So you would engage Canonical, and say, this is our stack. Here's the box. Here's the IP addresses. Here's the passwords. Full end to end, or is it literally just this? Can we have an escalation point for this?
As I understand it,
right?
I think there's a handover, and I think what would happen at that point is that Canonical would redeploy that system with your configuration, using Juju and Mass and all of that stuff as part of the suite of tools that they can orchestrate and manage those things easily with. They can do that on-prem on your existing stuff, or if you've got a big new data center build out, you can actually have them go to the data center with the equipment, build out the whole data center, bring everything up, get the whole thing running, and then they can either hand the keys over to you and say, there you go, you can now look after it, or do you want us to look after it from afar? And these engineers, for those large deployments, they're effectively, they might be Canonical employees, but they work day in, day out at that facility for that customer. So it can be from discrete services and components right the way through to a full data center build out.
That's quite cool.
Okay. So just coming up my head around it. What about, so just, it might not work, but I mean, well, one of our, what we do is we use Tinker NetScaler, which is a priority software load balancer. We can get physical ones, but it's basically Citrix. It's basically built on OpenBSD. We had they went to version 11, and one of our customers said we had to go to version 11 because it had a feature in it. They had to be for PCI compliant. Okay, So we put it up to version 11. It got that feature they wanted, but we found a bug in it where it after 2 days it got to 90%. Of CPU memory usage, so we had to throw that over to the second one and then reboot the backup ones. Okay, it took us going back with a premium support contract with NetScaler to solve that issue. But in the end, it was some sort, I don't know what it was. It was something they fixed it in their back end somewhere, but they couldn't roll back to the lower version because they had to have that feature in version 11 for the PCI command. How would that kind of work in with open source kind of thing? If you found a bug or something in there, I don't know how that would. Does that make sense? Or
yeah, I mean, but what you're describing here is that this company has got effectively a black box solution that is a load balancer.
Yeah.
And under the hood, it happens to be running BSD and probably HAProxy.
Yeah, it is.
But they sell it as you plug cables in here and you turn it on here and magic happens.
Yeah.
So that's their responsibility. They're building a solution. you shouldn't have needed to go through that processor, and it was a bug in their product, which they needed to fix. When you've got the orchestrated cloud parts, it works a little bit differently because it's orchestrated through Juju, which can deploy these things and orchestrate and manage it all, and we can go backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
So if you needed to go backwards, and also I know that they're very good at this, actually fixing stuff quickly, because it's a very popular part of the business and we've got loads of people coming over to support it. So we have a whole raft of stuff you can do, but there are products and services that are like flagship things that we guarantee quick turnaround support on. And okay. I don't know what the terms of the SLA are, but it's measured in hours.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, so I've not in this, so... My background is in the security sphere. And again, most of the products that we deploy are proprietary ones. So I've felt your pain. Absolutely. I know exactly where you're coming from because issues. I think for me, because this podcast is not just aimed at guys in solutions integrators like yourself or I. It's also aimed at people who are doing like the smaller office and the, you know, even individual support stuff. I mean, obviously I'm standing in for Andy here. So I'm having to represent the on-site support guy. So if I as a one man band had rocked up to, you know, so Andy does a lot of work with dentists, I seem to recall.
Yeah. Dentists and estate agents.
Yeah. Which, you know, having worked in that role, it's a good, stable group of people that are unlikely to go away anytime soon. You came from a large data center background, Martin, and you work in large deployment models. So I guess it makes it a bit tricky for us to answer for more kind of like the Andes of this world.
Yes.
But so if like an Andy were to go to dentists and they deployed Ubuntu on sort of 10 machines and they were using, pulling names out, you know, Colab and, Horde or something on top of that lot. Is that with the stuff that you're talking about from the Canonical side of things, could you do the same thing with 10 machines, a server running an Exchange replacement and a mail replacement?
Are you talking about as a managed platform?
Yeah.
Yes, you can. And you don't even have to get into a contract with Canonical because the tools and the software that are used to do this, anyone familiar with Mass, do you know what I'm talking about? It's Metal as a Service. It's basically a means of actually orchestrating the bring up of the hardware in the data center. So using things like, Pixie and IPMI and all sorts of system level integration to remotely power on devices and configure them, you can actually point a collection of boxes and bring them up. And once you've brought the hardware up, you can then start lobbing containers into them and orchestrating those containers to create your infrastructure. And this is where scale up comes from. But those tools, all of that for Mass, and then Juju is what's responsible for deploying the containers and the applications in the containers and orchestrating the clusters and what have you. All of that is open source software. So if you wanted to learn about how to do this stuff, you can do it all for yourself and use the same tools. And the way I used to do it for small scale stuff like that, I would learn it, deploy it, and manage it myself. But I did work for smaller organizations where it was very sort of piecemeal solutions and we couldn't afford to go to Canonical or Red Hat to buy a service. So I learned how to do that stuff. But the last job I had was massive data center and we were still a bank of sysadmins looking after thousands of servers. And actually the better way of doing it now would be to just say, you know what? We don't need this bank of sysadmins here. We should just, because it wasn't our core business. You know, you've got a lot of IT in organizations running these large data centers that don't have anything to do with the core business of the company. So why are you doing it? Get somebody else to do that and focus on what your business is.
So I think the main parts that I'm getting from what you said there, and again, I'm trying to channel my inner Andy here. So effectively, what we're saying is that really automation and sort of management of the orchestration and automation is really kind of where us as sysadmins probably need to start getting to in the next, you know, because really, realistically, you know, I remember when the kind of the automation tool of choice was, you know, shell scripts.
Yeah.
You know, and SSH. And then you had like parallel SSH stuff.
Yeah.
And then somebody sort of came along with Puppet and Chef and Ansible and Juju. And you know, and so these are all in the grand scheme of things, you know, compared against Ubuntu, automation is probably something that's for mortals. Is the sort of stuff that you'd be looking at probably within the last 5-6 years, really.
It's been around longer than that, but it's become relevant in about 5 years ago. And obviously, Juju is what Ubuntu is very interested in. I've looked at Puppet and Chef and Ansible in the past. And actually, what I do, even for my own systems at home, where I might do something once, I do everything with Ansible. So when I deploy a setup at home, I write Ansible deployment scripts for it. Because one day, that box is going to die, the hard disk is going to die. It's exactly what happened to me in the hot weather 2 months ago. I lost an array of disks in my home server, and I need to recreate it. Now, I have to go to the expense of buying new disks, but once I've got those connected to the server, I can run my Ansible scripts and I'm back up and running and restore my backup and I'm good. So I do everything as a matter of discipline with Ansible, because it's a good discipline to have. Because if you're an admin looking after one or two servers and you're just SSHing into the servers and looking after them, that's fine. But if your business is successful, in a few years, those two servers are going to be 20 and then it's going to be 200. And if you've not got a good discipline at the outset, you're going to run into a lot of technical debt and scale out issues later on.
You sure you're not Jerry? Because he does Ansible. That's what he does in his job.
Right. I am not Jerry, but I'm channeling my inner Jerry.
Yeah, because I think it's definitely the way I'm seeing things going that everyone's telling you we should learn PowerShell in the Microsoft world because everything is doing PowerShell scripts. I mean, as in the previous podcast, I've been doing a lot of work on cruise ships and the satellite link across to get to administer these servers is very, very, very laggy. And trying to set up servers is a nightmare. And if I had more time to do it, I'd want to automate it because everything I was doing, I was clicking, waiting for the mouse to move and doing it. But because I didn't have the time. Yeah. Because I didn't have.
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
But because they had set such a downtime that we had to get this done, we didn't have time to write the script to do it.
Right.
So I had as well, everything had to be done by the end of the month. And so it was literally, we need to do this.
Interestingly, when I was first looking at getting into automation, I was pointed to a talk on PuppetConf, which was their new CTO? CFO, something like that. So he'd been recruited in. He'd come from a firm, from an environment, was nothing to do with programming, basically. He was recruited in and he's almost like a method actor. You know, he kind of gets into the role for months before he, you know, delivers that one line saying, hello, darling, or something like that. And so he said that when he started at Puppet, he would wipe his machine every morning and rerun his Puppet scripts to bring his machine back up. And if it didn't work, he would make a tweak to do whatever it was to fix that for the next thing. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely. And actually, changing it more to what you were saying, you know, you were going into a cruise ship and you were going to run this stuff to run a deployment. There's a really useful tool called Vagrant, where you can, like, emulate environments. And that it might not necessarily be a perfect deployment for what you're going into. But if you know, if you can get the config from the box that you're running and bring up a Vagrant machine of that box, you can then write your PowerShell scripts before you get to the customer's site. Mm-hmm. So that when you get there, you go, click. Okay, that's done. Okay, who's up for tea?
Yeah. So I've used Vagrant in the past. I had a Vagrant configuration that replicated the infrastructure of the cluster, but a single node for each thing. So on a local workstation, you can bring up an analog of your infrastructure, and then you can run your Ansible deployment across that and validate it's all working before you actually go to production. And, you know, the way I was doing things is you actually had a test bed deployment system. So through the CI, you'd build all of your new software. You'd have the automation, deploy it to the test bed. You'd then do the integration tests on the test bed. You validate that, and now the deployment happens. And that got very close to continuous delivery. So commits land, it goes through the test bed, we validate, and then it lands on production. And we were doing 7 or 8 deployments a day like that.
And interestingly, I mean, it's not exactly a like-for-like situation, but I remember when Alan Pope, who's another one of the podcasters from the Ubuntu podcast, he used to have a little project he called, was it his mum's PC or something, where he basically had a virtual machine image of his mum's Ubuntu machine, which he'd basically every couple of weeks he'd go around to, or every few months he'd take another snapshot of her machine, so that he could basically bring up that virtual machine of his mum's computer, and without having to be connected over the internet, and literally point click, point click, point click to work through. So you could, you know, and to be fair, the sort of deployments you're talking about are, I can't speak for exactly what you're in, but it's probably going to be like a one-shot deployment. You're going to go there, you're going to run this thing, and then you're going to walk off, and that's going to be the last time you...
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So going in there on day one and saying, I just want to image every one of your machines. Okay, thanks, bye. You know, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Probably wouldn't have flown very well. But, you know, it's, if you know what you're going into on day one, you know, even if you can do something off, you were saying you've got high latency, high lag. You know, if you walk in and say, I need images of your machines. Can you just, you know, run this command, you know, the next time you're in port, to yes, copy everything off and ship the disks to us, and then we'll spin up a virtual environment. That's potentially not that I'm wishing to suggest to a rival firm how to how to operate their business.
Yeah, well, on the shift we've got an image of a template of what the VM should like, what so the Windows 2012 R2 image was like, but we would clone it. Well, you deploy a template from it, deploy a VM from it, you sysprep it, so you get a new SSID on it. And then I wanted to run the script, so it did everything. It put it to domain, put it in the right OU, that kind of thing. So
you can absolutely do that stuff with Vagrant. So the last role that I had in Fujitsu was I ran the labs for us. And we were using Vagrant virtual machines. And as the Vagrant machine came up, you could tell it to run a load of PowerShell. And one of the PowerShell commands it was doing was form a domain. And that one was join a domain. And that one was, you know, do this. So you can do that. And if you've got virtual machines already, you can, I think it's Packer is the thing you can use to convert a pre-built virtual machine into a Vagrant box. So definitely doable.
Okay. Did you want to ask me a question?
I did want to ask you a question. So obviously, you're predominantly working with Windows Server, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So my question is this, and I'm not being mean, I promise. Given that we've had a conversation here about Linux and open source technologies and the dominance of Linux in server and cloud and its pervasiveness and its growth in all sectors, do you feel that your career trajectory is limited?
Yes and no.
Whoa. Handbags out, sunshine.
No, I'm not being spiteful. It's a genuine question because, you know, I used to do Windows enterprise architecture stuff, and I deliberately got out of it to move into Linux on a full-time basis after having worked in the Unix world.
It's interesting because, I took the roles that I took specifically to get out of doing Windows support. And then ended up being back doing Windows support. So, I don't know about you, but I don't feel limited by Windows. In fact, if anything, with the automation, services, I feel like, I feel because they target not just Linux, which obviously is the mainstay of all these boxes, but Microsoft are making a big play to make sure that the orchestration and automation tool sets definitely Ansible, probably Puppet as well. I don't really tend to do a lot with Puppet, but the orchestra automation tool sets will target PowerShell actions. They will write stuff specifically.
So I suppose my question is, do you think that there's going to be customer longevity in requesting Windows solutions?
Yes, because I think, seeing it from my side of things, one of the reasons why I like open source, I want to learn it, understand it, in case it does all go tits up kind of thing, so that I've got something to go back to. But I am seeing in Windows a lot more automation. If this is it imposable, where you're saying you just roll things out, you build something and it commit. And I'm still seeing people writing code and then getting the SQL database and uploading the ASP pages to the cloud. Whereas I still see there's lots of people out there doing Windows stuff. I don't think it's going to go away. I think Microsoft have kind of doing this whole thing where they're doing the whole, So I think it, and I think there's, again, there's always the people there who want to do the easy thing of me going around clicking left, right, and that's what they do. But I think there's going to be a time when people need to learn PowerShell, and that's why I'm kind of in the moment trying to learn coding, because I want to know. I can write PowerShell scripts to do things, but I want to make it so that better, basically. And that's one of my things that I like about open source, is that it kind of teaches me to do, and then I can, what I learn in PowerShell, I can kind of put it again into Linux, but then the other way I can do Linux kind of thing and then put it into my concept of
so turning that slightly on. We're running close on time, so I was going to turn it on its head and ask you something similar about, but I think I'll leave that one to another time. So the next time that you and I and Andy are in a room together, perhaps I can be not Andy again, and
I can be not Jerry or something.
And
thanks Martin, thanks Jonathan for joining us today.
Thank you
very much.
You're welcome.